Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, June 29th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Jody Kretzmann, continuing his series, Building Strong Communities. What can the church contribute? Let's listen in.
Why aren't you hiking?
What
are we doing in a dark room like this in the middle of the mountains? High Tape Ministry, my name is Jody Kretzmann, and we're here doing a series of discussions this week about community and about the powers of community and about what I think is increasingly rationally thought about as a kind of movement across the United States to rediscover the power of local communities as problem-solving tools. Every session this week, this is the fourth of four sessions on community building, on building strong communities, and this one really is going to get toward a discussion, I hope, that we all can have about the place of the church in community building, and where, in fact, local parishes fit in this emerging movement. I've tried each time to summarize a little bit what it is we're up to in this work, which has now taken us to hundreds of communities. A lot of it, as many of you know, is summarized in this book, Building Communities from the Inside Out, which I understand now the bookstore doesn't have any more of, but here are order forms for it if people don't have it yet, and I'll leave some of those with John at the bookstore as well. Let me do a different kind of summary this morning. We've been thinking about how it is in the last 40 or 50 years, with all the best of intentions, we find ourselves in a kind of dead end in terms of solving problems in a lot of our communities. And one other sort of simple-minded way that we've begun to think about this, Mary, you're thinking about systems stuff all the time, is to think about two problem-solving tools. We've been talking a lot about gifts in these sessions, and I have to say that one of my gifts is not drawing something. The only two things I can draw basically are a triangle and a circle. And what's really fortunate for me is that I can now explain almost all of the universe with just those two things, so it's not too bad that I'm impaired in this way. For us, the triangle has come to kind of be the symbol of a kind of way of structuring our activities together as human beings. It's the systems way. It's the institutional way. It's got some hard edges to it. It's got a little hierarchy to it. It's formal. People have roles in it, right? And as we know from Native people across the globe, the circle is always the symbol for community, right? It's always a little bit curved, a little bit messy, a little bit, it's a different reality than the systems and institutions reality. I guess the way I'd summarize what it is we're sort of exploring these days is that if you think about these two ways of doing business together as two different kinds of tools for solving problems, the systems institutions tool and the community tool, what I think we're beginning to see is that up until about 50 years ago, certainly in the world of my grandparents, everybody assumed that this was the tool that solved problems. That people in relationship with each other, messy, but always consensual, usually sort of small d democratic, acting as subjects, not as objects, that people over here were always involved with each other in relationships which partly were the ways in which problems got solved. But that what we've spent a lot of time doing in the last 50 years is creating huge systems and institutions to solve problems. And that's, I think, led us into some difficulties. This is a set of structures, these hierarchies, these bureaucracies, where most of us live, I mean, and work, right? I work in a university, and that's this world. It's formal, it's hierarchical. It was probably invented, I suppose, or perfected at the beginning of the industrial age when it was invented to get the ideas of a few people into the hands of the many, right? That's what this structure is good for, and it still does wonderful, work. It was made to make sure that we know how to make Fords, so that somebody could imagine a Ford automobile, and then somehow the structure would be there so that that idea would get into the hands of the many. This is a structure, in other words, that's good at making a whole lot of the same thing, right? That's what this structure is good for. This structure can't do that. There's no way this structure can make a whole lot of the same thing. This structure is terrific for making Ford automobiles and computer chips and Boeing 727s and a whole lot of the stuff that we depend on in our lives. We, though, I think in the last 40 or 50 years, have begun to ask this structure to produce things like care or fourth graders. And it's not quite the same kind of question. Do you see what I'm saying? It could be that what we've got now is a situation where we've got huge systems and institutions which have squashed the capacities of communities. And one of the things that I think we're up to here is trying to see what functions have been moved out of community over into systems that might be moved back into community. In other words, for example, it's pretty clear that the safety level of a community, we're learning more and more, has nothing to do, right, with the number and strength of the police force, of the professionalized system or institution that's meant to make a community safe. In fact, what it has to do with, the level of safety in a community, has to do with the quality and depth of the relationships among the people in the community. If folks know each other, they know the kids, if there's personal relationships, crime goes down. It's just clear, couldn't be clearer. Has nothing to do with whether you pour more cops in, right? Could be the same thing we're learning about education and young people, that we've asked systems called schools to do a lot of the work that maybe ought to be done in families and extended families and in networks and in blocks and in churches, right? So another way of understanding what it is we're trying to think about here is what is the proper purview for this set of problem-solving tools, and what is the proper purview? I don't want to be hurt. Now, let me be careful here, because sometimes we get heard as being anti-institutional. I think most of us are people that have a foot in both of these worlds, in the systems and institutions world and in the community world. And we're trying to get people to think about the foot that's in the community world and its power, right? But I don't want to be heard as anti-system and anti-institution. When I get on a plane from SeaTac to go back to O'Hare in Chicago, I want to be in this world. I don't want to be in this world. I don't want a discussion in the cockpit, a democratic discussion in the cockpit. Which button should we push next? And where would you like to go today? I want to make sure the pilot came out of this system as a cookie-cutter pilot. He knows exactly what he's doing on his cookie-cutter plane, right? And that there's a routine about that. But I'm not sure that I don't want much more of a democratic discussion in the cockpit when the subject matter is our children and what they ought to be learning in school, how they ought to be part of the conversation and the community about what to do. So that's another way to understand what it is we're trying to do here, thinking about what sorts of tasks are appropriate to what sets of tools. One other way of quickly reviewing, a guy who's the head of the United Way in Denver, who's been working with us on this stuff, for his audiences of business people and other kind of givers, including some church folks, drew up this set of contrasting what he calls problem-solving models. And what he's saying is that we're moving from a kind of social service model to what he calls the community capacity building model, where in the older model, the United Ways and other funders and community problem solvers had always been starting with the deficits. Do your need surveys first. Tell us about your problems and pathologies. Instead, we're saying let's start with the full part of the glass. Let's start with the assets and skills and resources that are in the community. In the older model, you find a problem and you respond to it. You're always in the responsive mode. In the newer way of thinking about this stuff, the new old way, because it really is the ancient way, you're constantly sort of thinking about where are the opportunities. The old way, and this is going to get us into the church conversation here in a minute, is an orientation called toward charity. Right? What's important is to be charitably oriented. And the community way, in order not to sort of squash community power, problem-solving power, is an orientation toward investment. The old model leads to more and more services delivered by more and more professionals. And that's thought about in this way of doing business as a good thing. This model over here understands that every service delivered by a professional might in fact be displacing citizens interacting with each other in a problem-solving way. So it really emphasizes fewer services, right? Can we get the capacity to solve problems into communities and out of the hands of professionals? This one, particularly for United Way, has a kind of high emphasis on human service agencies, and this one has a much lower emphasis. And over here, we're always about fixing broken people, finding the emptiness and fixing broken individuals. And over here, we're always sort of looking into the collective surroundings around a person and asking, what's the community or the neighborhood got to contribute to problem solving in this particular case? Well, that's for two other ways to kind of come with the larger questions here. Either of those make any sense to people here, or both? Is it any reactions or comments to either of those quick summaries? You can see from the triangle circle stuff that it leads into some very complicated discussions about how one might think about recapturing these triangles for community building purposes. Right, we could talk a lot about that. Our communities are filled with these triangles, with branches of big systems, with schools and police stations and parks and libraries. And the question is, how would they be recaptured and refocused around community building kinds of activities? And that's a kind of other topic. Well, let's turn to the church here for a minute, and I want to just say a few things about the church and community building, and then really let's have a discussion, because again, I think this is stuff that's being invented even as we go. I sort of think of churches and their relationships with communities as having a being of three kinds, sort of. I still know an awful lot of churches where Sunday morning is the only focus, and clearly that's got some value to it, but it is the only focus, and there's not a whole lot of interaction with the community outside the doors at all, and probably we all know parishes like that, right? And obviously that's a valuable place for lots of people, but it's not what we're talking about this morning. Then there's a second kind of church, which I think is also valuable and has been, I think, the classic model for the local congregation interacting with the community, and that is the charity model. Are there hungry people? Let's feed them. Let's open a soup kitchen, right? Are there people in this neighborhood who need counseling? Let's make sure that we've got that available to folks here. Are there 12-step groups that need our space? Let's make sure that they can have our space. It is a service orientation. It's a model that says we do have resources at this place, at this church. Let's figure out how we can share those resources with the community. And we probably all know lots of congregations that are like that. What we're interested in, obviously, is congregations which are testing the boundaries beyond service and beyond charity, trying to move in a direction of community building, of, as the United Way graphic put it, from charity to investment in community capacity, in the community's capacities to solve problems. When I look around the country, I see three kinds of major clusters of activity that local congregations are engaged in already that move beyond charity into something else. Three sort of clusters of activity, and I just want to mention them and then throw the discussion open. And then I suspect there have been people all week here who've been involved in all three of these in various ways, and I hope we have some of you here this morning. The first is that never in the history of churches, in particularly urban areas, but also now in some smaller communities, has the church-based community organizing movement been stronger. How many people here have some touch with church-based community organizing of some kind, right? There are, in the last 15 years, the growth of
at least four major networks of church-based community organizing. It's the kind of organizing that grew out of the Saul Alinsky kind of style of organizing, where folks are very interested in getting together the local leadership and building a powerful local organization that can speak to outside players that are powerful in relationship to a community. So what happened about 15 years ago is that a lot of people looked at particularly lower income neighborhoods and said, well, where is the power that's already there and what do we need to convene? And a lot of folks said, well, it's the church. The church, particularly first in the Latino communities, this movement of church-based organizing, this current wave of church-based organizing, started with the biggest bang for the buck in particularly Mexican-American communities in the Southwest, first Los Angeles and then throughout Texas. Texas probably has the largest network of church-based organizations in the country at this point. The sort of dean of the networks, as many of you know, for church-based community organizing is the group called the Industrial Areas Foundation, which is the group that Saul Alinsky himself founded before his death in the early 70s. The Industrial Areas Foundation has clusters of church-based organizations throughout the Northeast and throughout the Southwest, really. Texas is theirs as well. And they've done astonishing things. Probably the most powerful church-based community organization in a city has been in San Antonio. Some of you probably know the San Antonio story. It's the story of COPS. It's the local organization there, Citizens Organized for Public Service, I think is their name. And it's a network of about 80 churches, began mostly Latino Catholic churches, Hispanic Catholic churches there, but now reaches into both Euro-American and African-American churches in the city of San Antonio. And it has redefined the power structure of San Antonio. There's just no doubt about it. You can't operate in San Antonio without operating with the church-based community organizations, with COPS. They redid the infrastructure of the city of San Antonio. All of the Mexican neighborhoods in San Antonio used to flood. They rebuilt the entire sewer system, a huge, huge project for a community because the churches got together and were organized to make sure that happened. Most recently, I was down there a couple months ago, and they're doing astonishing stuff around jobs at this point with these churches. They have negotiated. What's happened in San Antonio is that three of the major military bases closed, and they were places where a lot of particularly Latino folks were employed. The creation of the Mexican middle class in lots of ways in San Antonio was a result of the military bases there. And with the military bases closing, the whole economy is shifting in San Antonio. And so what they've done is COPS, the collection of churches, has negotiated with a whole series of large companies in San Antonio a set of agreements about hiring folks from the Latino communities. And COPS is the go-between between the labor pool and the companies. And one of the wonderful sort of ends of this negotiation is that no job starts at under $7.60 an hour. So that, and it's voluntary. There's nothing legal about this, but the companies have signed on to it because they've recognized that the existence of a Latino middle class is a very important strength for the San Antonio area. And the churches have been able to persuade them of that. So that's one of the instances. There are lots of others of church-based community organizing really producing stuff. If you go to Brooklyn, you'll see the original Nehemiah Project, which is a couple of thousand units of very affordable but wonderfully constructed housing in Brooklyn. And a replicable project project just moved to the Bronx in New York City, and they've done some work in Chicago as well. So the Industrial Areas Foundation has probably had the most success in church-based organizing, but there are three others. Let me just mention them. The Gamaliel Foundation, is that Gamaliel or Gamaliel? Gamaliel? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, Jeff, thanks. They're out of Chicago, and they mostly have organizations in Midwestern cities, including the Twin Cities. Both St. Paul and Minneapolis and its suburbs have church-based organizations connected with the Gamaliel Foundation. St. Louis does. The Quad Cities, Davenport, Rock Island, and so on do. A number of other places in the Midwest. Detroit has a Gamaliel group. And then here on the West Coast, probably the most powerful group is PICO, the Pacific Institute for Community Organization. located, headquartered in San Diego, but have organizations through Los Angeles and the Bay Area, and are connected a little bit in Seattle as well. And then there's one in the southeast called DART, the Direct Action Research and Training Center. All of them in constant conversation with pastors of churches, mostly in cities, but in smaller communities now as well, about how you put together a church-based power center that speaks to public authority and private power about community concerns and puts that agenda forward. It's something I think that Lutheran churches are beginning to get involved with more and more. And I'd like in a second to hear stories about those of you here who have been involved in those. Let me just mention the other two areas which I think churches are acting in now that move well beyond the charity orientation. I told the story at the beginning of the week about Bethel Lutheran Church in Chicago, about Bethel New Life, their growth from a little church of 38 people 15 years ago to an $11 million a year community development corporation. It's built 1,100 units of housing and has created over 600 jobs in that community. They're part of the national movement of churches into community economic development, the response to a lot of the conditions of particularly lower income and struggling communities that said, you know, if we don't pay attention to the economy here, if we're not about not only providing housing but creating jobs for folks, we can't possibly be serious about this community building stuff. So there has been over the last 4 or 5 years the formation not only of lots of pockets of church-based community development work, but a national network of church-based community development folks who now have annual conventions, and more Lutheran people are involved in those networks and discussions as well. And I think that's awfully exciting. It brings the church in touch with a kind of reality in terms of the shifting of the global economy in a way that I think is very exciting. And finally, there is the beginning of some church activity that moves beyond charity into some community building stuff that is more closely connected with some of the stuff we're working with here in building communities from the inside out. A number of churches, I told the story of a Detroit church where the pastor had his 50 top lay leaders do gift interviews throughout the community and locate in a very low-income community the gifts and resources and capacities and skills of low-income people, and then celebrate those by hanging banners about them within the church, and then dedicate his church to making sure that those people's gifts were given and mobilized over the next couple of years. That capacity inventory / gift interview approach is one that we're seeing more and more congregations beginning to think about. For example, a congregation in Cincinnati, which runs a soup kitchen, has discovered that among the 250 or so people who regularly use their soup kitchen, once they've started to ask, they are finding an incredible talent pool, right? So they've started to be very systematic about anybody who comes to the soup kitchen is asked, would you mind sitting down for 10 minutes and having a cup of coffee and telling us about your skills and about your resources, and then we'll think with you about whether or not we here at the soup kitchen could use some of what you know how to do, or whether there are other places in the community where you can contribute. And what they're finding is what we're finding over and over again, that when people are once again given the opportunity to say, you know, I've got enough in me that I can give it, I can contribute it, all of a sudden you're on a different set of relationships with that person. They have found at this soup kitchen, for example, enough cooks to replace everybody who once cooked at the soup kitchen. So the people who once cooked from the local congregation are off doing something else now, and the people who cook at the soup kitchen are people who used to come to the soup kitchen to eat instead, right? There's a Lutheran church in Milwaukee where, in fact, everybody who comes in for any kind of charitable, middle of a very poor community, any kind of a charitable handout of any kind shows up at the pastor's door, is required to do a brief capacity interview, and is asked then to be part of a set of discussions over a couple of months about how those resources can be given and how they can be a part of a community building kind of process. There's a church in Minneapolis, in South Minneapolis, that has just done, it's a Latino church on the south side, Catholic parish, just done about 500 capacity inventories of the Latino members of that church, and they were interested not so much in just how people could contribute to the church, because they were already doing that, but they were interested in jobs. They were interested in the hard economy stuff. And they found 45 people in the course of their interviews who have some kind of skills that they would like to, 45 folks, that they would like to translate into enterprises, into small businesses. And they were so overwhelmed, the folks who were doing these interviews in this congregation, so overwhelmed by the possibilities there, that the major thrust of that work is going to be to open a mercado, a Latin American market, on the south side of Minneapolis, where these 45 folks who do everything from, you know, cooking to crafts to auto repair are going to be part of this market. They're looking to open it in about a year. So we're more and more we're seeing churches beginning to think about how to reverse the arrow of the old charity arrow pointed from us to them. How can we serve? This is about a much more sort of equal exchange between church and community. How can we be in dialogue in ways that both folks share their gifts? It reminds me a little bit of the passage where Jesus is talking about the limits of servanthood, right? And is saying something to the effect that because the servant never knows what the master is up to, I've come not to be your servant, but to be your friend. And there's something about that lesson, about how we recreate our relationships on the basis of friendship, which has a more level playing field than servanthood, which sometimes, in fact, puts the server on top. So I guess my question, and here I want to stop and get into some discussion, is how deeply are we in the church addicted to being needed? Right? How badly do we need to be needed? And is it possible to wean ourselves of that, or at least to think about how we deal with our addiction in a different kind of way, in a way that in fact helps power to be taken by folks in their own lives? Let me stop there and ask. I'd love to have people now share where you are in your own congregation with these kinds of questions. Those of you who are involved in community organizing, those of you who are involved with community economic development, where are you? Jeff?
That's an interesting thing in the Gospel of John, where Jesus finally declares that he is going to be a good friend. And it seems that the foot washing is a beginning of that, because the first thing that he does is he sort of goes from being the leader to being the servant, and then he comes back up to being a friend. I think where we go wrong so often in the churches is that we assume, as you've talked about it earlier this week, we assume what the needs are instead of going to the people and being in community with them and then find out how we can be in community with them and then really serve at that point, where we've come to understand, come to trust that the people we want to be in community with, these people that we don't know yet, know something about their lives and in fact have something to teach us. I think that's the tricky part, is to really have a kind of peer relationship. And then, once you've got that, then you have to go a little bit further, I think, and you have to give up, divest, kind of go the second mile.
Yeah.
And I think that's the key to the Christian message in the New Testament. What Jesus was constantly doing was coming into situations he didn't yet understand. He didn't know what this leper was about, or this wound with the flow of blood. But then when he finally connected with them, he went the second mile and loved them.
Yeah. 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 And that sometimes means getting out of the way.
Yeah. Right, letting people do what they need to do.
I've got a Baptist preacher friend who who preaches a wonderful sermon about the passage about it being more blessed to give than to receive. And what he says about that is, he says, that's probably right, that the blessings go to people who give. And he says, our problem is that some people have been monopolizing all the blessings. and we need to even out the blessings. Right.
Well, I think it's taking seriously community. The main experience that I would relate from this in trying to figure out where servanthood was going to go was in house building, and well, my direction of a board of directors on that for a long time. And you know, our biggest problems were on the board of directors between those who thought they were primarily there on a charity-based mission. And I think that if you can take seriously partnership as a model instead of servanthood, that you're really having to be with these people. That's, to me, was where it all took place. And in the leadership of it, or the direction of it, that's where all of our problems were.
Yeah.
Trying to between those people who had the idea that we were in some sort of partnership with these people, and the people who had the idea that we were there to help them.
Yeah.
And that went from the board of directors through all volunteers, through everything.
Yeah.
And that was our chief problem that we were dealing with.
Yeah. One of the interesting things we're the work we're up to here is proceeding sort of on a national level at two parallel tracks. We're doing a lot of work on the one hand with local communities, where we're trying to learn how this community building stuff works, and people are making it up as they go. And so we got community stuff going on, not only in Chicago, but across the country. But the other track is with policymakers and funders and people with some clout. And what we're finding there is that the shift from, if we're asking partly for the dance to change, the old dance says, if I've got power and resources, I want communities to come to me with their hands out, right? And I will give them what we've got. And we're really asking for a shift to partnership is the word you're using, investment is another kind of word, but it's much more like this. It's from this to this, right? It's much more kind of give and take. It's a, we may not have everything we need in this community, but we've got everything we've got mobilized here, and now we need an investor, right, to move us to the next. And you'll get a return on your investment, right? What we're finding is that business folks, for example, understand that language in a way that I sometimes think they've never understood charity, right? They do understand investment, because you're partly saying, this is not worth investing in unless it's got a good chance of working. The effectiveness stuff, is this effective? Can this work? Has not been part of the charity language. That's not, doesn't even enter into our discussion when we're talking about charity. But the minute we're this in this kind of relationship, then we have to be talking about, is this going to work? Are these folks going to be better able after 2 years to solve their problems than they are now? And if so, that's worth investing in.
And that's, I guess, why I've stated that the church focus really has been helpful, because the piece that works is that when everyone understands that we're broken people in a broken world, and that all of us share that, then it's pretty easy to proceed on some kind of partnership basis.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not necessarily the outlook that any one community has, but it would seem to me an outlook that churches can easily impart to foster partnership.
Yeah.
Because they're supposed to be the places where people understand the sense of the brokenness of the community.
Well, and the other side of that is true too, I think. I mean, the good parishes, there are some Lutheran parishes like this, but the good old Catholic parishes in the middle of cities were places where the priest, the father, was terrific at finding everybody's gifts and finding a slot for everybody, and committees upon committees, and you know, guilds upon guilds, and everybody had something to do in a real working old-time parish. And you still find that in some of the Baptist congregations, where you know they'll have 60 or 80 lay ministers, all with titles and all with, you know, printed out in the bulletin every week, and all with leadership functions. And it's the way the church nurtures leadership. So I think the other thing that the church has to draw on, not only are we aware that we're all broken, but I think maybe equally importantly, is at least in some parishes, there's still the experience of people recognizing a whole multitude of different gifts and figuring out how to get those used within a parish kind of context. I think where a lot of parishes go wrong, I think, is when the pastor defines leadership in a very kind of narrow way, right? We do this in communities too. You know, leadership is defined as an unhealthy tolerance for endless meetings.
Right? we've had an interesting switch in the way we've organized our congregation in this last year. We're part of an Episcopal church, and we have a vestry of about 12 members, and each one had, the jobs were divided into 12 categories, and each one had, you know, responsibility for this one little area, and it usually was you and sometimes you by yourself, and sometimes you with two or three other people getting the work done, or not getting it done, or at least talking about it. Mm-hmm. But we've divided all, instead of dividing those roles up, we've brought them back together and divided them into five broad categories. Service, worship, education, evangelism, and pastoral care. And we meet one Tuesday, we have our business meeting as a vestry one Tuesday, and 2 weeks later, on a Tuesday evening, we have a community dinner, we have prayer, and then we have an hour and 15 minutes to get our business done. Hmm. And you've got, a group of people who divide into these five different groups, and the energy, the excitement that started to grow, and the numbers have increased from about 20 to about 50 who are involved in the decisions of the church, and then in reporting back at the end of our meetings, people start to hear about what's happening in the rest of the business of the church. So it becomes all of our business, and it's not one person trying to scratch up two or three to finish a job, but it has a lot of room to grow, and a lot of it's certainly not reaching into the community.
Part of the beauty of it is that these meetings are all open, and you can mingle. If you're tired of working with evangelism, then you can go over and fix the furnace. Mm-hmm. Talk about fixing furnaces or something else. There's no boundaries that way. Mm-hmm.
And you can't be everywhere at once, so each person has to decide where they're going to be, and you don't end up with one person with all the blessings of doing everything, or you have to be doing just one thing.
Yeah. And it changes and deepens and varies the relationships among folks, clearly. Yeah.
And just the grace of not having to make dinner that one night.
Yes, right.
The nights when my committee isn't responsible for dinner, I pick up something that's straight from the store to the place, and that in itself is a blessing.
Yes, absolutely.
But where the church has a problem with working with people who are outside the church, there's the people in the church who are trying to serve the people outside the church, and it goes back to the purpose of the church in the first place. We think we have something that everybody else needs. Mm-hmm. In other words, we got it, we know where it's at, and they need it. And so we translate the theological part of it into the social part. We got food, we got money, we got a roof, you need it, we can help you. So it's the same thing, only we're doing it on a material level also.
Yeah.
So if we're going to change and become partners with people outside the church and become friends, then we have to do the same theologically, I think. Mm-hmm.
That's a good point. Yeah. Laurel? Michael? Laurel? Whoever.
About 10 years ago, our church decided that the building itself was an incredible resource, and so they turned it into a daycare for you to low-income people. And then we opened up other rooms to work with the battered women's shelter in our community, and we've been doing a lot of that kind of work with 12-step programs and other things that you mentioned. But it's been a huge difficulty for the older people in the church that felt that their good works were in giving money to the church so it could be sent to Africa or to third world countries. And that the whole concept of service and partnership with the community seems very luxurious to them when there's huge needs in other parts of the world. Hmm. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Well, I think traditionally it's been easier to commit resources at an arm's length to scenes a long way away. That's been what mission has mostly been about, I think, for churches. Partly, I don't want to sound finger pointing here, because I don't think there are fingers to be pointed necessarily. I just think the world has changed. It's got to be true for most of you. When I think about my grandparents' world, they swam in community in a way that the fish swim in water. They never knew they were in it, right? But they were right in the middle of it. Their boundaries were set by their language, ethnicity, faith. And we're not there anymore, right? So we need to rethink what the relationship is between something called parish or church or congregation and the community around it, because they're not the same anymore. And therefore, we've got to, I think we're in a very new place. And I think a lot of the thinking you're talking about comes from an older place. And it's going to have to be stretched a little bit to be relevant these days. Michael?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about in terms of community building, hospitality, all of that, one of the things I try to do in working with churches, and this is often when they want to talk about their evangelism program, I try to get them to think in a different metaphor, that usually when we talk about evangelism, community building, hospitality, we think of ourselves as the church, as the host, and how do we become more hospitable hosts? And often what I do is, well, as we've been reading in our Sunday lessons from Matthew 10 and so on, I remind them, the interesting thing is that Jesus basically is telling the disciples not how to be good hosts, but to be good guests. And I try to help people in the congregation think through, what does it mean to be a hospitable guest in your community? And practice a whole community building effort around the metaphor of guest rather than host. And people begin to think about things much differently, because obviously, as a host, as a guest, you have a very different kind of behavior over against as yourself being the host. And so think about, here we are as churches, as guests in this community. Now how do we act hospitably? And some very interesting things happen.
I think it's something like that conception that begins to have begins to make churches think about being systematic about relating to all of the citizens' associations around them, for example, right? So that some churches have begun to be quite systematic about saying, what are the 150 groups within a half a mile of us that we ought to be, because we're part of their turf, that we ought to be related to, and how could we productively be related to those folks and their own agendas for what this neighborhood ought to be.
Joey?
Yeah. Yes, Chris?
That metaphor of the guest is a good way to get into the story of what I experienced. Last year I was doing internship in a congregation in Oakland, in West Oakland, which is a fairly poor neighborhood with lots of housing projects, about average income of 7,000. And the congregation I was working in was African-American congregation, but none of them, generally speaking, live in that neighborhood, and it's a middle-class church. Trying to figure out what to do in this predominantly African-American but very poor neighborhood. And one of the things that they've tried to start doing, I think, without naming it, is trying and say, well, we're this is our home. We used to live here in the 60s, but we're actually now guests in this community. And so they started going to church-based community organizing meetings. And it's interesting, they kind of combined that with the community assets mapping that you were talking about. And what they ended up realizing is that within the geographical boundary of this neighborhood, there was no bank, there was no good grocery store. And these are the people in the neighborhood who are least able to go somewhere else, because most of them don't have cars. And so then we started talking with other churches and making networks in the community, and we realized if there was a bank, then there's laws that require a bank to give X percent of its loan money to the geographical area around that bank, so that we could really put some pressure on a bank if we got one into the neighborhood to work on economic development in that neighborhood. And so all of a sudden, the people in the congregation involved in this started to see things from a completely different perspective and got involved with city council meetings and talking to the city council about the prices at the grocery stores in the community. We started doing comparisons between the price of rice and chicken in our neighborhood store and the Safeway or the Lucky's over in wealthier neighborhoods, and it was incredible. It was like twice or three times the price in the poor neighborhood for rice and chicken than it was in wealthier neighborhoods.
Sure.
And that kind of stuff was just mind-blowing. And it opened up ways for us to be involved as guests in that community in a way that built partnership with people that we didn't know. And for the congregation, that was odd because they're African American and the people American and people. You know, outsiders would say, well, no problem. But they say, we don't have anything in common with these people. We got to figure out ways to build bridges. And it's providing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the obviously the work of people like William Julius Wilson at the University of Chicago has, you know, what's changed in our cities is what you're describing, Christian. It is in fact the separation, not just by race, but by class, and the isolation of the poor in lots of neighborhoods, so that anything that reconnects the power of the professional and middle classes with the resources really that are still there in low income communities is something that we ought to be interested in.
Yeah,
that's exciting. Is that Bethlehem?
Yeah,
great.
You familiar with what's going on in Detroit? Or has been? This is years ago, and I went up there for 2 weeks as a class. And we were there to observe. We weren't there to do, but they put us to work one day, and we really threatened the people. And you talk about servanthood, that's what I was thinking about. But and it's talking about stores. At that time, there was no grocery stores in Detroit. They couldn't afford it because the insurance rates. People didn't drive cars in Detroit. 43 Lutheran churches had closed their doors, and the other churches, well, the African-American churches had kind of taken them over. And the Catholic Church had 100 and some parishes in Detroit, and they were really struggling. But the thing that I was most impressed with was this factory they took over. And I think it was connected to what you were talking about, to the industrial. But they had this factory that they trained young people. I suppose they trained old people too. They were all young people when we were there. And they made the, they rebuilt the transmissions. I think it was for General Motors or one of the big companies. And I just wondered, it just sounded like what you were talking about.
Yeah, there are, I think I know a couple of projects in Detroit that are like that, that have taken up old industrial buildings and turned them into a combination of training facilities and outsourcing repair and construction places for the auto companies. That's promising work. The other thing you're pointing to, I think that when Chris is talking about what happened in Oakland, when you look at what people think about as devastated low-income neighborhoods, the assumptions about there being nothing there are usually wrong, right? I mean, we did a little income study in a very, very poor public housing development in Chicago, where people thought there was really, you know, and there are, there's you know, probably 90% welfare population in this development. But what you find is, if you look at it from another point of view, that these two buildings have about $7 million a year coming into them, right? But the problem is, it leaks out right away, that there's no place in the community for people to buy anything. Doesn't mean they don't buy, it means they've got to, you know, van pool or get on public transportation and go 5 miles away to buy food. And so the minute you start looking again at the full part of the glass, what's there? What would you do with $7 million? So folks went back in there and said, well, tell us the three things you buy most of. And it turned out to be food and clothes. And there are now stores there because the market opportunities were spotted. There really is, there are opportunities in the inner city. And I think more and more folks who are simply interested in the bottom line profit are understanding that there are opportunities in the inner city.
Is that in Detroit? I haven't been, it's been 8 years, I think, since I was there. But I did understand it was improving, and I'm just wondering if it's...
Detroit's still a tough town, I think, in lots of ways. But there's some very interesting church-based economic development, particularly. Detroit has some of the most sophisticated local community development corporations in the country, and most of them have churches somewhere at the center of their operations. Yeah.
Yes. Jody, are you familiar with what's going on in Phoenix? Is your travels at all?
A little bit.
Are you? Well, I'm really pleased with what's going on through the Lutheran Social Service.
Huh, okay. Tell
Phoenix
us about it.
The county, Rosa. And how they relate to so many different groups are effectively or developmenting different programs, or maybe they're not the catalyst, but they participate in other capacities. And it's even though named Luther, they moved ahead and developed relationships with industry, the political scene, different church groups. They had got joint programs there. They moved ahead and developed housing programs that are atypical, that I've not seen in other parts of the country, for American Indians, Hispanics, community centers. Their whole program is really one of participation in certain areas of leadership and not in other areas. And I like that kind of model, too. I don't know.
Leaving space for other players.
Huh?
Leaving
yeah.
some space for
yeah.
some other players.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's smart. Yeah. We've some of the work that I've been most interested in and where we've been most fully involved in your area in the Valley of the Sun there is really in the Mesa side of Phoenix. And Mesa is very interesting from my point of view because a lot of our work was in older neighborhoods where we're working with folks to take another look at what's already there. In Mesa, they're using this capacity inventory idea and the idea of neighbors interviewing neighbors about what their skills and resources are to actually build community for the first time. Mesa is a place, as you know, right, that over the last 20 years has increased population fourfold. It keeps sort of spreading out into the desert. And so these are people who've come from all over the place with no relationships with each other. And therefore, they're using this capacity inventory stuff to build a community where none was. I mean, it's only in those brand new communities where you don't have any associational life to discover, and where, in fact, you've got to create your associational life, where churches come in and begin to create community rather than find it when it's already there. That's an interesting place you live in. Other experiences? Yeah.
Chad, a question, and that is, given the labor-intensity
yes.
of the doing these inventories, and then I assume the data collect, you know, then you've got to process it, and then you have to do something with it.
Yes.
I thought I heard you say something about using some university interns, or what are some different models for capturing, particularly I'm thinking of nonprofits, so I know that this session is more on the church. Voluntarism, but can you cite some
Well, we just had, yeah, just before I came out here, we had a wonderful two-day conference at Northwestern where we brought 20 folks in from across the country who'd been using this capacity inventory stuff in very different kinds of settings, you know, rural Northern California, where the whole county has 3,000 residents, to inner city Bronx, New York, right? Just the whole range of people who've been using some version of the tool. The lessons we learned are at least three. One, don't ever use what's in the book, right? Mm-hmm. Make up your own and tailor make it. Mm-hmm. I mean, this cannot be cookie cutter stuff. It's why Washington, D.C. never understands it, because this is not one size fits all. It is each community trying to figure out, what do we have here to build on? What's our peculiar arrangement of assets, and how can we connect them with each other in ways that make sense? So it has to be about a very local conversation. Secondly, the discussion ought to be first, what are we going to do with this stuff when we know it? If we knew what our neighbors could do, if we knew about all their skills, and had a whole lot of information about them, what would we do with it? If we haven't thought about that, you're going to get into the major problem of thinking about this sort of tool as data. And it can't be just data. So that's one reason to keep university people out of this discussion. They tend to look at anything that looks like a survey and they think about it as data. Our most embarrassing piece of work with this capacity inventory stuff was in a very poor town in Michigan, where people did 6,112 capacity inventories. Almost everybody in town was interviewed about their skills and their resources. And then they gave it to some university people who fed it into a computer. This was 5 years ago, and nobody can find it now. I mean, so all of that community building material is lost. Think about what it is they need to do
Do you want to build economy with it? You can do that. Do you want to build, connect cultural stuff into schools, as we talked about the other day? You could do that. Do you want to build a skills bank? You could do that. Do you want to do a learning exchange? Ask people, what would you like to teach? What would you like to learn? There's a whole lot of stuff.
You're putting the cart in front of the horse.
Exactly. I'm thinking about how...
What you do with it is what you do after you find out what people's gifts are.
You could, in fact, go that direction. That would mean you'd really ask a whole lot of questions. But you could also target it and say, we're really after economy information here, right? We're really after market stuff. That's right. But some attention to how are we going to use this stuff, right, is important. And the third thing I would say that we learned from these 20 people who came in and talked about their experience is that it really is about building relationships among people. And therefore, if it's a university student, it better be somebody who's going to have an ongoing relationship with that community. If it's just a one semester project and it ends at the end of the class, that's probably not a great idea. That this is partly about putting people together. That's why a church is maybe an appropriate place for this kind of activity to be centered, because the church ought to be the center of relationships in a community. Can be, anyway. So I think those three lessons came through about what to use, how to use this stuff.
So actually, another question, were some of the people who went out and did the surveys, were they always volunteers or were they sometimes paid staff for our...
Well, in some lower income communities, they got some money to be able to pay people $5 a survey or something, you know, so that you went out and did some conversations with your neighbors and then got paid for it. I mean, I think that's another discussion that needs to happen at the local level. I think pay has pluses and minuses about it. You might want to think about it.
We have, my community was called Healthy Community Initiative.
Yes, we worked a lot with those.
From Minneapolis, and building assets, mainly for youth that came out of concern for gangs and gang activity that was coming in. And having identified like a list of 65 assets that if youth have a certain number of those assets, they would be less likely to be at risk,
yes,
to get into behavior that was not healthy.
Yeah.
And so it has been divided into many different groups in the community, and they're doing some really wonderful things with trying to build those assets for all of the children in the community.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful work. We've done some work with the Search Institute, and they're building blocks for youth kind of work. I think they do some terrific work. I'd like to, we're pushing them a little bit more into thinking about how young people can be contributors, because I think that's a key. They understand that, but they're focused on a wider set of questions as well about young people.
That was one of the really interesting things to me, that one of the assets that was really considered critical was how much time did youth spend volunteering,
yep,
their time doing,
yep,
things for other people.
Absolutely. Gaining some valuable experience about what it is to be a citizen. Yeah. Well, we're running out of time here. I guess my sense about this work is that it really is in its infancy, I hope there's a sense for those of you who've started this work and those of you who are thinking about it. I hope you really do have a sense that this is really sort of creative work. This is about invention. This is not about receiving some kind of a model or something like that. I just want to, I think probably the place to end is where we decided to end the Green Book. And the last sentence in the Green Book, as some of you probably know, is the quotation from our friends in Mondragon, Spain, again, where they have probably gone further down the path of reinventing society and economy than any place else in the industrialized world. And when you go there, all over Mondragon, you see their slogan, right, which is, we build the path as we walk it. Right? Nobody's been here before. So I wish you well in your path-making. Stuff goes on. Holden is a path-maker, I think, in lots of ways in this realm. It's been a valuable classroom for me over the last 20 years. So, go in peace back to the sunshine. Mm-hmm.